That was a little bit of Sir Carter from trumpeter Jeremy Pelt's album Noir en Rouge live in Paris, with Victor Gould on piano, Vicente Archer on bass, Jonathan Barber on drums, and Jacqueline Acevedo on percussion. Jeremy Pelt is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast. This is our 21st episode, so if this is your first time listening, welcome, and if you're a longtime listener, welcome back. The Burning Ambulance podcast is part of the OSIRIS podcast network, which includes over 24 other shows on a range of subjects from music to craft brewing to parenting to literature and the arts, so visit OSIRISPOD.com to see what else they offer. I'm sure you'll find some others that will interest you too. OSIRIS is also partners with Relics, so visit Relics.com for music news and other stuff. And if you want to help us keep this show going indefinitely, please visit Patreon.com/BurningAmbulance and become a supporter. Jeremy Pelt is a fantastic trumpet player who's been on the scene more or less since the dawn of the 21st century. He did his first recording session in 1999 and made his first album as a leader in 2002. But his first sort of breakthrough came in 2008 when he formed a quintet with J.D. Allen on tenor sax, Danny Grissett on piano, the late Dwayne Berno on bass, and Gerald Cleaver on drums. He made four albums with that group: November in 2008, Men of Honor in 2010, The Talented Mr. Pelt in 2011, and Soul in 2012, and they're all terrific. That was where I started listening to him. I think the first album I heard was The Talented Mr. Pelt, and I went backward immediately and checked out Men of Honor and November, and then continued listening with Soul. After that group broke up, he started experimenting, changing up the musicians he was working with on pretty much every album. He made two records that went in more of an electronic fusion-ish direction, Water and Earth and Face Forward Jeremy. Then he made a record with two drummers, Tales, Musings, and Other Reveries. Then he made a quartet record, Jive Culture, with Danny Grissett back on piano and Ron Carter on bass and Billy Drummond on drums, who had been one of the two guys who played on Tales. And in the last couple of years, he's formed a new working band centered around his partnership with Victor Gould. He played on Gould's album Clockwork, and then he brought him into his band for the album Make Noise from last year and this new live album. That's not all he's got going on, though. Jeremy Pelt is on about a half dozen records coming out in 2018. He's on saxophonist Wayne Escoffery's new record, Vortex. He's on three tracks from organist Jared Gold's new album, Reemergence. He's part of the band on Don't Play With Love, which is a collection of pieces composed by Prince's father, John L. Nelson. He and saxophonist Jim Snedero recorded a tribute to Cannonball Adderley called Jubilation, and he's a member of the Black Art Jazz Collective along with Wayne Escoffery, and they just released their second album, Armor of Pride. We talk about a lot of those records in the podcast today, especially the Black Art Jazz Collective, so I'm going to play another piece of music now, and it's a track by that group from Armor of Pride. It's called Awora Ama, and after that, you'll hear my interview with Jeremy Pelt. A native New Yorker, are you? Where did you grow up?
I grew up, I was born in California, so I grew up between New York and California, in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when did you pick up the trumpet? Were your parents like supportive of your decision to become a professional jazz musician, or did they want you to get like a business degree or something just in case?
No, they were supportive.
How old were you when you started playing?
Probably about 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In school or just on your
own?
In
school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So back when the schools had instruments in them.
Yeah, yeah. When you were just starting out, like when you were in school yourself, like where did you go to study the trumpet?
No, I didn't go. It was in school. Just school lessons.
Uh-huh. But I mean like in college or whatever.
No, well in college I studied film score and so I went to Berkeley.
Oh, okay. What kind of program was that?
film scoring.
Like what does that entail? I mean,
it teaches you the whole craft of film scoring. So you take, you know, courses, varied courses like composition and also editing and all, you know, the whole craft surrounding it.
And how do you think that's influenced your compositions later in life? Do you sort of have, you know, pictures in your head when you're composing or anything like that?
Not unless I'm composing to something. For instance, I'm working on a piece right now that I've been commissioned to write by the Font organization, and it's going to be debuted in September. And my idea, my proposal for the commission was to write pieces based off of the sculptures of Rodin. So in that case, I chose several specific pieces and kind of wrote a story to it.
And so when you were at Berkeley, you were studying scoring and stuff like that, but what were you doing in terms of, you know, trumpet lessons or studying instrumental technique, anything like that? Was that just stuff you did on your own, or was that part of your curriculum? Or
it was part of the curriculum. I mean, it's a compulsory thing for the first couple of years, so you had to take lessons.
And who did you study under up there?
A few people. The last teacher I had was Charlie Lewis.
And when you were starting out and you were a student and stuff like that, who would you say the players were that you, because I don't, the traditional influences question is kind of dull, so I approach it from this angle. Like, who did you steal the most from when you were like just a student, and how long did it take you to work that out of your system and develop your own voice, or are you, do you think you're still on that path?
Well, I mean, I had a healthy dosage of listening to, you know, my contemporaries or I guess people that were maybe the generation ahead of me. So, you know, Nicholas Payton was about 3 years older than me, and he was starting to become like a big thing. And I admired his playing quite a bit. But I think Roy had the biggest impact, Roy Hargrove, when I was in high school and going into college. You know, he was definitely a, you know, big hero of mine listening to. And also Terrence Blanchard, but more so Roy.
I'm curious about your phrasing, because you have this kind of, when I listen to you, I hear that you have this kind of conversational feel rather than like a really high-powered approach to the horn, I feel like. And I'm wondering if your voice comes out of your temperament as a person or how it developed, you know.
I'd say it's probably an amalgamation of all the information that I processed over the years of listening. And, you know, you kind of self-edit yourself at a certain point. You know, that's the good thing about the technology as it is that you just listen to recordings that you've done and maybe say, oh, okay, well, this sounds something like something unique. I don't think anybody, no matter how much they try, or, you know, what hype they subscribe to is completely original. You know, I don't believe in that. And, you know, so I'm listening to myself, and yeah, they're the obvious influences that are there. But then, you know, the more you start to play and the more, you know, the years go by, you eventually do sound like yourself. And, you know, there are certain things that, you know, I might hear that are uniquely me, and I guess that's just a process of actually playing, you know.
How much does the actual instrument weigh into it? Because I've talked to players, you know, like Christian Scott, who has custom horns where the bell is angled up, and he says it gives him certain extra notes in one range, but it takes away notes in another range, you know, or people rely on a specific sort of custom mouthpiece. So how much of that stuff actually impacts the playing?
Well, it can. I mean, if you have a horn, much like any instrument, I mean, I've heard, you know, sometimes I'm surprised when I talk to piano players because I look at the piano, piano is just a piano. But then some people like, oh, I don't like the Steinways, I like Bösendorfers better, I like this. And it's like, it all feels the same to me. But, you know, to them, it's uniquely different, you know. And so, you know, for trumpet, or for, like, I was just using that as an example, but, you know, really for trumpet, a lot could impact your playing. You still, however, are going to sound like yourself. I mean, I went through a stage, you know, first, you know, when you start in trumpet, you're just playing what's given to you because you haven't earned the right to really be, you know, playing on anything, you know, fancy. Uh-huh. I didn't even own my first trumpet until 10 years after I'd been playing, if you can believe that. And then, you know, you get a horn and then you start to get more horns. And at that point, the custom thing wasn't really a famous or widely used thing. Okay, so Wynton Marsalis came out with the Monettes. I mean, well, Dave Monette came up with the Monette, but he popularized the Monette. And that might have been, you know, in the late 80s, right? And so that's when people started getting hip to customized trumpets. But after a certain period, everybody had one. You know, I started playing these custom horns. And, you know, they're good horns. They're very well made and, you know, supposedly made for you. But after a certain point, I started thinking about it. I was just like, you know what? I just want just a regular old trumpet. So you go full circle. You start on a regular old trumpet. Then you get a little bit of money and you get endorsements and all that. And then you're like, well, yeah, maybe I can get a custom-made thing and it's all shiny and you get different things done to it. You bend the bell and you do all this. And then after a certain point, you're like, you know what? I just want to go back to just a regular trumpet. Mm-hmm. Because that's the best sound. All my favorite recordings of cats are on a regular trumpet. You know?
Yeah. Now, after Berklee, what was your path to New York? Did somebody hire you, or did you just move to the city and say, I'm going to make it? You know, what happened?
That's exactly what I did. You know, I mean, I wasn't going to stay in Boston, you know, and so the path was Directors 95. You know, you just get on the highway and 3 hours later you're in New York, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And nothing was handed to me. You know, I had a day job for the first 6 months that I was here. And, you know, I was making jam sessions. I'd met people because, you know, Berklee was the type of place, Boston, rather, was the type of place where cats would come in town and they'd maybe play at Regatta Bar or play at Scullers. And then after that, if they still feel like hanging, they go down to Wally's, which was the local jazz hang. And it still is. And everybody that's come out of Boston has really spent time at Wally's. You know, Roy would go there when he was a kid, going to, you know, at Berklee. I mean, everybody. Mm-hmm. And so when they come back in town, you know, and play these, you know, the bigger clubs, they always come down to Wally's and hang. And so I tended to meet a lot of the cats there and, you know, exchange information and then just really keep in touch. So it wasn't as though I moved to New York and I was a complete unknown.
Yeah.
But there was still some, you know, climbing to be done, but yeah. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And I looked up your, you know, like your discography and stuff, and obviously, and was Soul Live your first studio session?
No. My first, it was probably my first notable one. definitely was my first notable one. But my first ever record date was from a guitar player. He's a Polish guy named Jarek Smetana, and he sadly died a few years ago. But he released a record with Gary Bartz, and it was called African Lake. And Eddie Henderson was supposed to do it, and Eddie couldn't do it, so he recommended me. Eddie's always kind of been my mentor and been, you know, been in my corner, so he's always throwing me work, you know, back then whenever he couldn't do things. And so he got me on this date, and that was my first ever recording.
Wow.
That was in 99.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So what was that like when you walked into the recording studio for the first time? Like, you know, were the other guys like welcoming? Did they know it was, you know, that you were basically a virgin walking in, or what?
The funny thing is, I don't remember many of the sound men. I remember the side man, right? I remember Jarek, the guitar player. He was very nice. Gary Bartz, I remember, and he was very nice as well. He had some good company words, because, you know, much like I do now, even though I'm a lot more accomplished now than I was back then, but I always had this, you know, kind of funny feeling about recording. I hated going in the studio because it's just an unnatural environment. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of had to cheat your way into making unnatural environments seem natural, and there are those that are very good at it. And I'd be playing some of these songs, and, you know, maybe I might crack a note here, or, you know, make a mistake over there. And, you know, Gary was very just chilled about it, so he made me feel comfortable, you know, about whatever mistakes, you know, that I made that to me seemed to be, you know, these big production, you know, mistakes. And he's just like, man, that's nothing, man, you can't play everything perfectly. You know. Yeah. So that's one thing I do remember. But I don't remember any of the cats being mean or anything like that, or any type of way, really. I think it was just a very, you know, welcoming environment. We did the date and that was it.
Yeah. You also made a couple of records in your first couple of years there with Lonnie Plaxico, and then a couple with Vincent Herring as well. Mm-hmm. What did you take away from those situations? What were you like learning when you were, you know, making records as a younger guy?
You know, it's funny. That's a good question, because see, with Lonnie, one of the things that I learned, I really dug his approach to making the record, and also just introducing me to other people. Like, he was the first person that introduced me to Joe Fields over at High Note, which, you know, I eventually signed with. Mm-hmm. And while he was taking me there to the office, you know, he gives me this talk, and he's like, hey, listen, you know, should Joe offer you a record deal, yeah, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen, but if he does, don't ever think that you have to hire, you're indebted to me, you know. Which, and it had a profound effect on me, you know what I mean, just in terms of thinking, because I do know other cats that are like, well, I hooked you up with the record deal, you don't want to use me? And he was completely the opposite, and I never forgot that. And I, in turn, chose to be like that with other people that I've hipped. In the studio, he did something that I still do to this very day, which is, and I knew exactly why he did it. He started with the slower songs first, the ballads, if there were any. And that's because usually when you go to the studio and they tune the piano for you, you know, over the course of the day, it's going to get, you know, more out of tune. The more it's played, which is, you know, as a side note, you know, whenever we recorded at Rudy Van Gelder's studio, he had the piano that was actually going to be on the record, and then he had a side piano, And that side piano, by the way, was the piano that everybody from Thelonious Monk to Herbie Hancock played on those classic dates. That was the rehearsal piano. And he said, so anytime you had to, you know, do a rehearsal, he'd ask you to get up from the regular, you know, the recording piano and go to the rehearsal piano because he didn't want it to be out of tune.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so when Lonnie started doing that at his sessions, I always kept that in mind. So anytime I go in the studio, we always start with the slower songs because you want to get, because, I mean, that's when the piano is more exposed. Mm-hmm. You know, when you start doing, you know, louder songs, then you don't really hear it being out of tune as much because there's so much other shit going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that's something that I've taken away and I've been doing ever since. And Vincent, you know, Vincent was... He's a tough act to follow because Vincent is one of those people that I was kind of talking about in terms of people that have just a great recorded presence and has it together in the studio. You know, one of the things I learned about Vincent was that, and he'll tell you too. He said if it's his date, you know, and he gets a good solo on a song, it doesn't matter what anybody else sounds like, that's going to be the take. You know what I mean?
So he's
always upfront about that because he's not the type of person that likes to splice a lot anyhow. So that's another thing. So we don't really do that many edits when we were doing his projects. You know what I'm saying? So I had to sound decent following him, you know, or because I mean he's not the type of person that's going to be in there like, all right, let's do another take, all right, let's do another take. You know, he's not like, so I know people that are like that. He's not like that. So I mean, it just kind of made me get more focused.
Yeah. I would imagine that starting a session with the ballads would also help the guys in the band to kind of focus their minds, you know, because when you're playing slower, it gives you an extra couple of seconds to think, and then you're that much more prepped when it's time for the faster material.
Sure, well, it's like a warm-up, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Certain people, I mean, I even hate doing other people's dates where they want to start with the fast stuff. I'm like, oh, no. Because I'd all, you know, if I had my druthers, it would always be the ballads first, but, you know, I don't have a say when it's not my date. But, I mean, it's a good warm-up, especially for a brass player.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. Now, you spent a couple years in Ralph Peterson's band with Jimmy Green, Orrin Evans, mm-hmm. and Eric Rivas, and you've worked with mm-hmm. some of those guys on other albums, too. So, like, how tight a band was that, and how close are you with those guys to this day? Was that, like, a big formative experience for all of you?
I think it was. I mean, what Ralph kind of envisioned of that band was... See, Ralph always kind of envisioned himself as the Art Blakey for the new millennium, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that band in particular was the band where he would start bringing young cats out. I mean, he always had bands, but they were usually cats from his generation. So when we did Art of War and Subliminal Seduction and Death of Time, that was really a working band. We did maybe one or two European tours, and you know, we tried to get some dates. I should say that one of the things that I learned about Ralph, or from Ralph and Lonnie, was, and actually Vincent too, was how, you know, how well they hustled, you know, mm-hmm. for work. You know, how hard they worked at, you know, trying to keep things together, which also had a profound effect on me to this day. You know, we were tight in that we would do several gigs a year. It was, you know, we wished that we could have worked more, but it was what it was, you know.
Yeah.
But we had a great time, you know, doing, especially Art of War. Art of War was such a special record to me. I think if anybody in the band, if you ask any of them, I'd venture to say that was probably, of the three, the most special because we had just done an engagement over at the Jazz Standard. So we were hot going into the studio the next day.
Okay.
I mean, and we burned through those 11 songs, or 10 or 11, I forgot how many songs. We burned through those songs in 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And that was with the lunch break. So a lot of that was, you know, first takes. And, you know, how close we are, you know, life happens. You know what I mean? I got kids. Orin's always had kids. You know, Jimmy, we all know, you know, what happened with Jimmy Green, unfortunately. And same thing with Eric. So, I mean, we all have families and things that we had to, we're working towards and things that we're striving to do. So it's not as though, you know, we don't talk to each other. It's just that, you know, everybody's doing their thing, you know. I will say that we kind of did come back together when Sandy Hook happened. Mm-hmm. You know, that was, and you know, that was a terrible, you know, way for us to come back together. But I mean, we, you know, because I hadn't talked to Ralph in years, and if anybody, I was actually closest with Jimmy, because not only were we doing Ralph's band, we were also doing, we were at one point when I moved to New York, Jimmy moved a year before I did, but when I moved to New York, we were kind of like the front line du jour. So I mean, a lot of people were hiring us together, and another band that we worked in was with Lewis Nash. So, I mean, you know, we were pretty close. Plus, we were the youngest. Well, actually, I was the youngest in the band. Orin and Jimmy are the same age. And Eric was a bit older than us. And then, of course, there's Ralph. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we were kind of close.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, David Murray said something similar to me about what you were saying about recording the album, because he said he likes to get a band to play like a week at a club right before a recording session so that the band is really tuned in and hot, you know, and then you can just go in and get and have that same energy in the studio.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it's in history too. I mean, when you look at, like, let's say any of those Miles Davis recordings with that quintet, I mean, you know, they're coming off the road and going in the studio, or sometimes they'd be in the studio on the road, you know, during engagement. So, I mean, they were always engaged.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of that band, you played on one track on Wayne Shorter's album, Alegria. Did you get much time to hang out with him in the studio and ask him questions, anything like that? Like,
No. You know, that's it's a claim to fame, but it's one of those things where there's not much I could say because that was an overdub situation. What happened was Todd Barkin, who I'd met and who started, you know, programming me for things when he was over at Lincoln Center before they moved to Jazz at Lincoln Center, he had recommended me to this producer named Robert Sadin. This is when I first moved to New York. And he said, yeah, I got this trumpet player here. You should hear him. And so, you know, Robert got in touch with me. Robert's a crazy, just crazy guy. but he had me come over to his house, and he had a home studio in his house, and I met him then. And he had some kind of scratch track that he wanted me to just, you know, flow over, play over, you know. And so I did. And he's like, oh, man, this, you know, he said, oh, this is fucking awesome. This is great. You know, hey, look, I'm doing this, producing this thing with Wayne Shorter. And, you know, I want you to play the parts on it. Yeah, this is going to be great. Man, and, you know, every time I play something, I'm like, oh, man, it's fucking awesome. You know what? I'm going to call Wayne right now. So he calls Wayne down in Florida. And I'm sure Wayne is like, why is this kid calling me? You know, and he's like, hey, listen, Wayne, I got this young kid. He's new to New York, you know, and we're going to use him on some of the brass stuff on the record, man. But I just want you to just talk to him, say it. And that was probably the longest conversation I had with Wayne, which wasn't long at all. It was just, you know, him saying, oh, okay, yeah, where are you from? Oh, okay, well, don't give up. You know, it was that type of thing, you know.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But when we actually did it, when we got to the studio, and I mean, Robert had me shedding this part. It was off of, you know, it was funny. You mentioned that, you know, I had a little gathering yesterday and I was playing some records on a shuffle on my computer, and that track actually came up. This was last night. I kid you not. And it was me and Steve Davis and Chris Potter, just overdubbing parts at a Sears Sound studio.
Yeah.
So Wayne wasn't there. I mean, that stuff had already been done. The principal production had already been done maybe a year or two before that.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So how did your quintet come together? Did you know that those were the four guys you wanted right away, or were you testing out lineups or whatever? What, you know? How, tell me the story.
Which one?
Your quintet with JD and Dwayne Burno. Those guys.
Yeah, well, you know, that was one of my that was my favorite group. You know, it was a very special time and a very special group to me. And I just look back on it with a lot of fondness. Dwayne, I'd known for ever since I moved to New York, and we played together in certain situations. And I called him for some gigs when I had a, because before the quintet, I had a sextet, you know, and we were doing gigs because I recorded something off of on Crisscross. And so I'd have him do some of those gigs and odd gigs around town. So he was always very reliable. Danny had just moved to New York in 2003. And, you know, his name was starting to get around and we'd do some gigs together. And I just liked him, aside from his playing, which is great, it's masterful. But I also just, you know, liked just his attitude. I guess the bigger story is JD and Gerald, because I was thinking about putting the band together anyhow, and I definitely wanted JD based off of the fact that I had done JD's record a few years before I put that band together, and JD did a record on Crisscross called Pharaoh's Children.
Yeah.
And I listened to it and I just felt like we had a connection. Even though I was a late add on that record, I wasn't even originally supposed to be on it, but it still, we had a connection, you know, and I was always looking for a way to kind of include him. Now, the interesting thing about Gerald was that Gerald just out of nowhere just reached out to me to do a gig with his band called Violet Hour. And I'd seen his name. I didn't even know what he looked like. I didn't know anything. I'd just seen the name around town for a while. Truth be told, I wasn't even sure what instrument he played. But he reached out to me, like, you know, I enjoyed you playing and this and that. And I want to know, he sent me an email. I want to know if you could make a gig and a rehearsal. And he told me all the cats are going to be on it. And JD was on it. So, yeah. And this band was, it was an interesting band because it was myself, JD, Chris Lightcap, Ben Walzer, and Andrew Bishop. And I wasn't sure where Gerald's writing was coming from. You know what I mean? Because the times that I did see that name, it almost seemed like it was more of an avant-garde thing.
Yeah.
So when we did have the rehearsal, most of that music was very rooted in some kind of swing, you know what I mean? And I was like, wow, you know, and we did, I think one of the first gigs we did was at Cornelia Street, and I kept turning around and just looking at Gerald like, damn, this motherfucker can play. And so we did one of his records. I think it was a record called Detroit, and he recorded it. He had an idea to record it all in one room at a club in Brooklyn called Barbez. And we did the record there, and there was, I'm going to tell you, the defining moment. I forgot what the name of the song was. But if you have that record, it's a song where JD's not soloing in the front. He's soloing at the very end of the song. And it's a powerful moment because Andrew and I are playing these kind of like choir like lines against Gerald, kind of bashing in a, not bashing, but in a kind of like a Elvin Jones-ish type of thing at the very end, and it's almost holy in a way. And on top of all of that was JD just flowing over it, and it was that moment where I said, I need both of these two in my band. I remember that clear as day. Yeah, and so that's how they came together.
Yeah, and you guys did 4 albums in 5 years, and then that was it. And did you feel like the band had run its course, or were there like external factors as well? Because I mean, those guys all had a lot of other stuff going on, obviously.
Right.
So
yeah, I kind of, the thing with me is that I do things preemptively when I feel like it's going to happen. So I after Soul, which was the last record, it did get harder to acquire the cash to do it. First of all, Gerald was always, off times, I should say, not always, but off times he was unavailable for a lot of gigs and tours that I had lined up. I mean, he made some tours with us, but others he would just always be busy. JD was always, by my side. He was cool. And Dwayne was always, by my side. Danny started playing with me first before he was playing with Tom Harrell. And then when he started playing with Tom Harrell, then it got, it was like, I'd have to get my call in before, Tom got a call in so I can get him on a gig, So, it started to run its course in that sense that, everybody was coming less and less available. And after a while, it just stopped making sense to try to do gigs with, a band full of subs, And so that's what happened. I mean, Danny had also moved to Vienna with his wife and his child.
Oh, well, that'll do it.
And so, yeah, there was that aspect too. So, and I'm not blaming the whole, disbanding on that, but it certainly didn't help. So, yeah, that's pretty much what happened. But, the other thing that was in the back of my mind was that nothing is forever, and also and it's kind of, it's going to sound weird, but I wouldn't want this band for 10 years. I love them so much, but I wouldn't want this band for 10 years. I look at some people, I've had bands like, obviously Keith Jarrett. I mean, what didn't Gary Peacock just leave that gig, after like 40 years or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Or you look at even Dave Moran and the Bandwagon, and he had that band 15 years. And when you guys have it and you're on that level, that's great. For me, I didn't envision the band lasting much longer than it did.
And then after that, you started the band with 2 keyboardists and electric bass for Water and Earth and Face Forward.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a surprise coming out of the quintet, but it was also sort of a throwback to the Shock Value album that you did from 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you decide to kind of refocus on that side of your music?
Because I hadn't quite, I still had more to say in that regard in terms of writing. And I didn't, after I disbanded the quintet, I was just looking for something that was going to be, a vastly different from the kind of sound that I was already getting with those cats,
Mm-hmm.
So, and with those cats, I mean, JD and Danny and the bunch. So I wanted to have just a different kind of palette. And so that's why I decided to revisit that format, with the electric band. And, that's pretty much what the reason was. And that's in, the other thing is there are some songs that are on Water and Earth, just like there are songs that are on Face Forward. And there are songs that are on, that I've kind of, you know, dispersed over a lot of different records that I've done, that all stem from the first band that I actually ever had when I first moved to New York, was a band that I put together called Creation. And that band never recorded. One of the things that I was disappointed about when I was with Max Jazz was that they didn't want me to record that band because they didn't feel like it was going to go anywhere, radio play, or certainly not touring wise. That was probably the most adventurous band that I put together at that point, which was myself. Myron Walden was playing bass, clarinet, and alto. I had Warren Wolf on vibraphone, I had Derek Neverhelt on acoustic bass, Tommy Crane on drums, and Mike Marino on guitar. And the sound was a very fresh sound. But because the wind had been blown out of my sails, I had to disband that. And so what was left was basically all the songs that I had written for that. And so I started to think, well, okay, let me just go ahead and, you know, like you mentioned Shock Value, that record. The first song on there is a record song called Circular. That was from Creation, you know. So I was just like, well, okay, maybe I could adapt these songs and, you know, these different band formats. And so, you know, when I did put together, those bands, it was kind of almost a take on Creation.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the two albums you did after that, Tales, Musings, and Other Reveries, and Jive mm-hmm. Culture, those were mm-hmm. both very different from each other, because you had the double mm-hmm. drummers on the one, and then on the other mm-hmm. was the quartet, which it said yeah. in the liner notes, I think, was just basically an excuse to work with Ron Carter. So
yeah, that's, yeah.
it kind of felt like you were experimenting and you didn't really want to settle in with a new band just yet. Was that what was going on?
That's completely what was going on. I felt like, you know, the first quintet I had was the band at this point. So, you know, if I don't ever play the trumpet and somewhere in a new jazz history book for modern times, they talk about Jeremy Pelt, and they say, okay, well, his first, you know, important band, you know, the same way they say, you know, Train's important band or Miles Davis's first important quintet, you know, that would be the band with JD and everybody. Mm-hmm. And it was such a, even though I tell you that I didn't see it lasting for much longer than it did, it still left a huge void in my soul when it did disband, you know. Mm-hmm. And even more so when Dwayne died. I immediately put together another band, the Electric Band, and to see what I could do with that. And even before I had the quintet, I had a quartet where we were doing the music from Identity. And we actually were working for quite a bit. So my point is that I'd always had bands that I was working for and trying to get work and everything. And after a while, I was just like, after I disbanded that Water and Earth band, I was just tired of trying to, you know, have a band. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I was just like, let me just do, conceptual projects, you know. And so that's when Tales, Musings, and Another Reveries came about. And to this day, that's still one of my, you know, proudest recordings. And with Jive Culture, you know, it like I said, it was an excuse to work with Ron. I mean, I remember being in Europe, and I was just like, you know, I'm trying to figure out a way to, you know, work with Ron. I keep running into Ron. And, you know, I called Joe Fields. I said, I got it. How about we do a record, you know, just quartet, swinging record, you know, and I'm going to have Ron. And Joe loved the idea. And, you know, I spoke to Ron, and Ron was in, and so it was great. And so I just got cast that I like to swing with, and that's what we did. I mean, you know, I don't have any reservations or any, you know, misgivings about it being, you know, a seminal record or, you know, important in any type of way besides it just being, you know, a feel-good record, and it just so happened to have Ron on it, you know, but you know, when placed you know, Up Against Tales, Music of Another Reveries, or Soul, or November, you know, or even Water and Earth, you know, it's certainly not up there. But I did enjoy the experience.
Now, how does making a record that exists just for the studio impact that year's gigs?
You know, what was interesting was that, see, when you do a quartet recording, even when it was Ron, I can do that anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, I could work anywhere. People already know that you're not going to come with Ron.
Right.
You know, it's just not going to happen unless they have the money to go ahead and pay for Ron. And then Ron would have, and trust me, I even tried to get Ron to do a gig with me here in New York, and I couldn't get him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like we came very close and then it didn't happen because he got another gig someplace else to pay more money. So I was just like, well, you know what? It is what it is. We can still do the music from this disc. We don't need Ron. We'd love to have Ron, but we don't need him. Same thing with Tales, Music, and Other Reveries. I mean, I obviously knew that I wasn't going to be able to take this band, particularly with two drummers on the road on any kind of extended tours. So I went into it with that understanding that this was just purely something of me taking a snapshot of a moment. However, I did end up doing two engagements in New York over the span of a year with that band, with two drummers. And then I did do some other festivals and other gigs playing that music. And some of them had Billy on it, and some of them had Victor mm-hmm. Lewis on it, you know, but it was just the one drummer. And, you know, both of them had Ben Allison and Simona on it. So, I mean, we were still able to do things, but not in that, you know, with that two drummer thing at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And now, though, on Make Noise and your new live album, you do have another working band. So how did that group come together?
Well, at a certain point, I decided that I wanted to have a band again. You know, it's certainly not any kind of profound amount of years that I've been away from wanting to be a band leader. You know, the interesting thing about it is if you break it down to instruments, if you're a trombone player, you know, you're kind of in the big band system, you know, or Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, piano players, you can always be a sideman. You know, occasionally there's some that step up and do their own trios. Drummers, you know, they're starting to get a little bit more love right now, but I remember Lewis Nash being frustrated for years that he had this great band that nobody was booking, even with all the star power that was in the band. But he was still kind of relegated to the featured sideman role. Saxophone players, it could be the same thing. You know, they kind of do things with themselves. There's not very many saxophone players, quintets, that have trumpet as a sideman. I mention all that to say that trumpet is always thought of as an instrument, especially if you have recording solo recordings and you kind of made a name for yourself in a certain type of way. You're always expected to be the leader of a gig.
Mm-hmm.
And so to that effect, it was almost like I had to form, you know, I'm always hustling to get gigs anyhow. Every tour I do, I book myself. So to make it interesting for the person that's buying the band, you know, I decided that let me go ahead and start writing more original music and, you know, conceptualize putting together a new band. And it came through, it went through a couple different changes. At one point I was like, you know what I want to do is a band with just guitar and bass, you know, acoustic guitar and bass and percussion. And we tried something like that, and it didn't fly at all. Not one bit. You know, there was some, yeah, it just didn't fly. So, and I was missing both the piano and the drums, because there's only so much power you can give for percussion.
Yeah.
So I went back to the drawing board, and I start, you know, Jonathan Barber, he started with me because he studied with Eric McPherson. Eric McPherson played with me back in 2004 and 2005. And when I was looking for somebody to sub for Gerald Cleaver on this last tour that I was doing, I called Eric, and Eric said, "I can't do it, but you should look out for my young student, Jonathan Barber. He's about to graduate college from Hart." This was in 2011. "And you should give him a call." And I remember Jonathan from when I went up there. I was teaching at Hart. And I remember, even prior to me teaching there, I remember him because I did a clinic there. And I was, you know, cats were playing in their ensembles, and I was appraising everybody's playing. And I remembered him as being somebody to watch. I wasn't particularly impressed, but I saw the makings of something that could, you know, develop. So when Eric told me about him, I was like, well, let me see if I, you know, I love Eric, so let me see if I can give this cat a call. And so I did call Jonathan and set up like a kind of a audition. And I had him, you know, follow me around. Like, he was at the studio the whole time we did Soul. So he was always watching Gerald Cleaver, and he was very observant and picking up on the right things. Mm-hmm. And so I started to use him as a sub on a lot of tours that Gerald couldn't make. And so that kind of got him, you know, immersed into my music. And even after I disbanded that band and I started doing some, like, you know, pickup dates in Europe, where I would just take him and I'd use a, you know, bassist and a piano player from out there, I'd call, you know, Barber, "Hey, come do this." So we were used to playing together at a certain point. So he was a natural call, and I felt like he deserved at this point to be to actually found, as it were, you know, the drum position in my band, in a new band that I'd start. And so that's how he made it in there. Vicente is always somebody that, you know, we go way back to college, and he's appeared on several of my recordings, and I've always loved his playing, and so has everybody else, which is why he's always hard to get. But I mean, so that was a no-brainer. Had him in mind. Victor was also somebody that was on my radar. And he expressed a lot of interest over the course of some years about wanting to play with me. But I just had other things going on, so I didn't really give him much, especially since Danny was still on the scene. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the interest of putting the band together, I said, "All right, Vic, it's your turn. Let's, why don't you come over and let's see what you got." And I was writing this music, you know, and then, with Jacqueline, we had done, I was teaching over at a Samba Meets Jazz camp in Bar Harbor, and she was up there studying, and I had to drive up there, and so they rented a car for me and everything, and they said, "Do you think you could, Jacqueline lives not too far away from me, do you think you could, she could ride with you back to New York after the camp?" So I said, "Yeah." So, I mean, that's like a 9-hour drive or something like that. So we had a lot of time to talk in the car, and that's when I had, you know, told her I was putting together this band, and she, you know, was very adamant about me. I should give her a chance, you know. So I went to her studio, and we, you know, I gave her some things to check out and see how she worked on it. And I tried it, and, you know, it worked. You know, mm-hmm. Now sad, you know, and then we did Make Noise, and we did the live record, and you know, I think it captured us on very great days.
Yeah, yeah. And you were also on Victor's album Clockwork. Was that before, mm-hmm, Make Noise or after?
That was before Make Noise, I believe.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
And what were your thoughts about his compositions and stuff? Because that's a pretty interesting record.
Yeah, I was completely floored, man. And, you know, I didn't know that he had this much depth, you know. And I was very impressed with the whole thing.
Yeah, that record kind of came out of nowhere and hit a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, no, this is a special record.
Now, you're also part of the Black Art Jazz Collective, in addition to your own bands, and you just put out the second album with that group. So tell me a little bit about the history of that band and what it means to you, because obviously, like, the name alone is a statement before you even get to the music, so.
Right. Well, the band came together via Wayne. Wayne Mascoffrey, I kind of call him the heartbeat of the band, you know. He was the one that expressed, you know, a desire to kind of put together a band to celebrate, at first to celebrate, the mission was kind of to celebrate Black icons, you know, through our artistry. And he called myself and Jonathan Blake. We met at a bar to talk about how we should put together the band and who should be in the band. And so after we decided on the musicians, then we just called and everybody was down to do it, you know, especially because we all wrote music. And so that's how the band came together. And I think it, you know, now with us having been established from the first CD, second CD comes out, and it's really now more reflection on our art that we bring to, you know, when we put, you know, a pencil to paper and we write. So it doesn't necessarily have to reflect any one significant period in Black history as much as it's supposed to really reflect, you know, our joy of playing together and our celebration of playing this Black art form. And so that's what it is.
Yeah.
The record came out real nice.
Yeah, no, I mean, the music kind of reminds me of that kind of super high level acoustic jazz that was like in the late 70s, like Woody Shaw's bands or like Eastern Rebellion, you know, that kind of traditional but forward-looking kind of stuff. It feels like that's sort of what you guys are pulling from in a way, even though it's like all or mostly new music, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's the idea, you know? I mean, everybody, the kind of pedigree that's in that band is, you know, we have all played, you know, we're all kind of 6 degrees of separation from, you know, those kind of bands, you know, like the Woody Shaw bands or the Eastern Rebellion. I mean, I played with Cedar for years, you know, and, you know, that's, you know, obviously Jonathan Blake's dad being who he was, I'm sure Blake was around McCoy, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. So, I mean, you know, you have that, we all have that to draw from, and it really goes into our music.
Yeah, yeah. And then you also made another album this year, which is the one with Jim Snodaro, dedicated to the music of Cannonball Adderley. So what can you say about that record and what your, you know, what your mindset was going into that project?
Well, that was, you know, Jim, that was a situation where I'd never met Jim before. Okay, let me back up. We did last September Smoke. And he called me, we're on the same label. So he was interested in working with me, and so he called me. We'd never met before, but he knew of my work, and obviously he knew that I played with Lewis for years and doing that music. So I guess I could only imagine that it would be, you know, as stress-free as possible for him to have me on the gig, because I already knew all the songs. Mm-hmm. And we had a good weekend at Smoke. And so he got very excited about wanting to do it, particularly because Cannonball would have been 90 years old this year. So that's really what the idea was behind it. And, you know, we kind of rushed into the studio in December, you know, because he was very adamant about doing it because he felt like he can get some work behind it, and it's starting to pay off. I mean, it was a fun day to do. Mm-hmm. You know, with the cast that are on there, it was definitely a fun day to do.
Yeah. Now,
you know, I mean, it's a tribute record, you know, with a couple of original songs on there, you know.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where you don't need to look into in depth on it, you know. But, you know, all I can say is that it was just a fun day to do. It's kind of like, you know, Jive Culture. It's like, it is what it is, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, under your own name, I mean, you've got a lot out right now, but
mm-hmm.
under your own name, you make an album a year with High Note. So
mm-hmm.
does that inspire you, or is there like a feeling of pressure, like, okay, there's an X on the calendar, and I've got to come up with a concept and a set of tunes by that date every year?
What's interesting is that High Note has never said, you have to do a record. It's time for you to do a record now. You know, so there was no pressure from that side. When I was, going back to the quintet days, when I was on Max Jazz, and we did November, and that was kind of like the end of my Max Jazz days, because even I started doing Max Jazz with Close to My Heart. That was 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of schedule that I was on with Max Jazz was almost like a record came out every 2 years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of getting on my nerves, because I was starting to get excited for things that I wanted to record. But, you know, he was like, nope, you got to wait. And so you'll notice that Shock Value came out right after November, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end. You know, I pitched that idea and they went for it. But that was also kind of the end, or maybe, yeah, I think, yeah, Shock Value came out a couple months after November. That was really kind of the end of that relationship with Max Jazz. So that when I did record with High Note, and that was Men of Honor, was the first record that I did, I was excited to do a record every year because we had been producing music on a more constant basis. So it was more about the band. You know, it was more about how much I was writing at that time that I felt like I needed to, you know, get this out. So when we had that band, you know, we did Men of Honor, then we did Talents of Mr. Pelt, and then we did Soul. That was all because I was writing at, you know, a high, you know, frequency. You know, now with records like Water and Earth and whatnot, I was still writing then, you know, because at that point, I wanted to have just a stream of consciousness. I wanted to have a new project out all the time. I do feel like, you know, now I'm going to try to slow down a little bit after this next thing that we do in September. But this project coming out in September is something that, you know, I've been wanting to release for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've actually been writing for this specific thing. For the grant that I was telling you about earlier with Rodan, and it'll showcase my working band. You know, by the way, Jonathan Barber and Jacqueline Acevedo are no longer with my band anymore. So I've got Alan Mednard on drums and Ismail Wignall on percussion, and so this will give you guys a chance to hear them playing in the band now, alongside Vicente and Victor Gould.
Yeah.
And I'm also going to have a young vibes player named Chain Chain Lu. She's from Taiwan. And I'll also be bringing an old band member back in, Frank LaCrasto, who's going to be playing giving some keyboards on it. So it's going to have an interesting kind of tonal quality to it. And that's why, you know, I'm looking forward to recording that. What I'll do next, I don't know. You know, maybe it would be good to take a break. But, you know, I guess getting back to answering your question, there was never any pressure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, High Note and Savant were holdouts for a long time, but now they've started putting some of their new releases on Spotify and other mm-hmm. streaming services. What are your thoughts on streaming music? Is it helpful? Have you seen it bring you new listeners, or you know, has it not really had an impact on you one way or the other?
You know, what's interesting is that I always agreed with High Note about them not putting the stuff on the platform. And so I was always, you know, solidly with them. But one of the things that you really kind of succumb to is if you can't beat them, join them. And they sure as hell can't beat Spotify at this point. So, you know, even though you're making, you know, pennies, you know, fractions of pennies, you know, a little bit of something is better than nothing. And, you know, even at this point, and I did make a post about this, I think, a long time ago, is that, you know, I used to be so against Spotify and all that. Now I'm just like, you know what? What battle am I fighting? To what end? I even have Spotify. And yes, I will stream shit in a minute now. I'm just like, this is the society that we live in. It's almost like being like, okay, well, you know, I'm against, you know, CDs. I just like vinyls. I just have to have vinyl. Now, yeah, vinyls are coming back in, but I mean, you remember back in the day when, you know, everything started to come out on tape and then CDs, and everybody was excited about CDs because they didn't have to lug around, you know, 12-inch, you know, records. So now you have these, everybody jumped on that bandwagon because it was convenient. You know, and more so when the first iPod came out. I remember I was like, that first iPod came out and I felt like God sent this to everybody. You know, I felt like it was the greatest invention in the world because I was one of those people that would be on the road with, like, you know, a CD book, you know, of like 100 CDs. I'm shipping that. I'm carrying that all throughout Europe. You know what I mean? Now I got this iPod where I can have all my music on this little device. You know? So that's another thing where everybody jumps on the bandwagon because it's convenient. Now we have streaming. It's wildly convenient. Now, what does that mean for the artist? Well, you know, we're making fractions of pennies. Now, at this point, the argument is this. I mean, if I'm Madonna, or if I'm, you know, some pop star that is already selling, you know, millions of records worldwide and got gold records, you know, and that type of thing, then I would be a lot more pissed. You know what I mean? Because now you're seeing your earnings go down because of it. The advantage that I have, and it's, you know, it's the advantage as well as a disadvantage, but more of an advantage, is that there was no threat of me selling a million records in the first place. You know what I mean? You know, I'm not Michael Jackson, so it's not happening. You know, so it might as well be on there because everybody else is on there, and because that's the new standard for people that are booking you. You know, so now they go to YouTube, they go every place except for getting your CD, because who's got CDs? I mean, it's a hard sell now, even just to sell CDs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Because everybody's like, damn, well, I don't even have a CD player. And the way I'm looking at it, I don't have a CD player anymore, except when I get in my car. And even then, I got Bluetooth, so I can go ahead and stream. What I just took my kids down to Virginia, you know, last weekend. All we did was stream Spotify. It's a hell of a lot easier, you know, or satellite radio, you know?
Yeah.
So I mean, I've definitely succumbed to it. I'm not trying to rationalize me not making as much money as possible, which is why I really do wish the best for radio, because I have seen a generous revenue, you know, off of my records being spun on, you know, public radio. So so I don't ever wish that to go away, or else it'll truly be a sad day.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean for you know, fans and whatnot? I don't know. I guess there are people that, you know, are checking my music out if they're, you know, doing, you know, mixes on Spotify, and that's great. There's only been one instance where my record was being played on one of those kind of, I think it was Slacker or Slasher or whatever, I forgot what the site is.
And somebody found me through there and reached out because they wanted to use my song in a made-for-TV movie, you know? So I guess these things can happen every once in a while, you know, but, you know, it's few and far between.
Yeah, yeah. Now, some jazz performers in the last couple of years are reaching a younger, less traditional audience of people who've come in via hip-hop or indie rock or R&B, you know, like I mentioned Christian Scott earlier, or Robert Glasper, you know, people like that. Do you think much about who's listening? Do you see a portal into that realm for yourself, or are you a guy who's in the jazz club and festival world and, you know, you're established there and that's kind of your lane? Like, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, you first of all, you had to abandon the jazz festival for jazz artists, you know, approach, because, you know, the jazz festivals got more hip-hop acts than the hip-hop festivals. You know what I mean? So those festivals, and I've seen that happen, and I've seen that grow, that kind of thing really take shape over the past 20 years, you know? So now, you can go to a jazz festival and this is going to be, you know, such and such jazz festival, and we're going to have one jazz artist, and then everybody else is like, you know, and Macy Gray's over here, and Kanye's doing this, and, you know, it's like, okay, so where's the jazz? I'm very conscious of what they're doing, and I think it's great. I think, you know, it kind of takes you back to the Shakespearean, you know, quote, to thine self be true. You know, you have to really be true to what it is that you do. Is there a portal for me? I don't see it yet, you know, in a way that I could still be me. I love what Robert's doing. I love what Christian is doing. And it's, you're not going to, I mean, it's good music, you know, it's passable. And some of it is very good. And they're great at doing it. I couldn't do it. And I think if I did, everybody would be scratching their heads, because it really wouldn't even come off as anything remotely authentic. You know, it would sound like me trying to chase what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Which is jumping on the bandwagon. And I won't be a part of that. You know, it's just really the way that I kind of think about it is me trying to add my thing, you know, and whatever I hear today that I like, I kind of put it into my aesthetic. Now, is that going to make me as popular as they are right now? Doubtful, because I think what's happening right now is really very much, I mean, when you look at the artists that are out there, you talk about Christian Scott and Keon Harold and, you know, and Robert Glasper and everything. I mean, it's very much, you know, an R&B based, you know, thing. And that sound is what is in right now. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't have anything in my music that uses that sound, nor do I want to. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But, you know, if jazz is taught us anything, is that, you know, these things do change.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's you know, I at this point, I've been here 20 years. I've seen a lot of things already, you know, go and come, and it'll happen again. You know, you just have to really just keep reinventing yourself in a way that is true to yourself.
Okay, that was my interview with Jeremy Pelt, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the Osiris Podcast Network. Visit osirispod.com to learn more about the network's full range of shows. Visit relics.com for music news, and please consider supporting Burning Ambulance on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Osiris.